Hello and welcome to Making a Killing, the podcast from Hudson Institute's Kleptocracy Initiative on how corruption is reshaping global politics. I'm Nate Sibley, a Hudson Fellow, and your guide on this journey into the darker corners of the global economy. Huge news from Washington this week, as President Biden issued a policy memorandum that establishes fighting corruption as a core US national security interest. The memo kicks off an interagency process whereby all the relevant federal departments and agencies across the US government now have 200 days to come up with a plan for the president himself on how they will elevate and accelerate their role in the fight against kleptocracy. Also this week sees the launch of the first ever bipartisan caucus against foreign corruption and kleptocracy in the US Congress. So a real double whammy of good news. And I'll be diving much further into what these developments mean with Paul Massaro and Casey Michelle later on. In fact, I have a third bit of good news for our listeners this week. Long-time subscribers will know and love Paul and Casey as my energetic co-hosts, but this week they also joined me at Hudson Institute as Kleptocracy Initiative Adjunct Fellows. This means they'll not only be doing research and events at Hudson itself, but also conducting some of the interviews here on Making a Killing. In fact, Paul's going to kick us off this week because he sat down recently with Leonid Volkov, who is Chief of Staff to Russian opposition and anti-corruption leader Alexei Navalny. As we've discussed in the past, Navalny and his colleagues have uncovered mind-blowing corruption by Vladimir Putin's regime and led the democratic opposition to his increasingly authoritarian rule. Navalny was poisoned last year, but returned to Russia, where he's currently in prison with rapidly deteriorating health. Let's head over to Congress, where Paul works, and hear from this week's guest, Leonid Volkov.
My name is Paul Massaro, and I'm a policy advisor at the U.S. Helsinki Commission and an adjunct fellow at the Kleptocracy Initiative. I am here with Leonid Volkov, the chief of staff for Alexei Navalny, who is making a trip to Washington, D.C. So this is one of our first interviews that we will not be having virtually. This is in person. He is right here physically in front of me, Leonid Volkov. And I'm wondering, what are you doing here, Leonid? What are you doing in D.C.?
Well, as one might easily guess, I'm here not just doing some tourism. It's by the way not it's by the way not possible to come to US for tourism now from Europe. You're just not allowed. But I'm doing some meetings because of the upcoming summit in Geneva with President Biden and President Putin. I think it's very important to deliver the message from Alexei Navalny, from the Russian opposition, to American decision makers to give our perspective on the policy with regard to Vladimir Putin and with the recent developments in Russia.
That's fantastic. And what is that perspective, Leonid?
And that perspective is, if we put it shortly, that Vladimir Putin is a guy who doesn't understand the language of negotiation, of compromise, of building bridges, of pushing the reset button. Well, the world has tried to push the reset button many, many times and failed. So our message is that the language should be adjusted and the approach should be adjusted with regard to this experience that the world has gained dealing with Vladimir Putin. And this is to gain leverage, to talk to him from a strong, powerful position, and to make him sure that he will not be able to get away just with his new crimes and so on, that he couldn't expect to be forgiven for what he does.
I see. So should the summit go forward, in your view?
Yes, of course. I do not object against the summit as a matter of fact. Talking is always better than not talking, but talking about what? Talking about like bringing Putin back to the table with all the serious guys, like signing new treaties and agreements. In my opinion, this approach just lacks some very basic logic. Putin has violated his own word so many times with respect to so many different circumstances that how could now one rely on his word? So Russia is a founding member of the OPCW, the Chemical Weapons Prohibitions Organization. And as its founding member, Russia violated all its possible statuses, trying to kill Alexei Navalny with Novichok, and not only Alexei Navalny, trying to kill many others,
right,
and developing a new chemical weapons program, which is strongly prohibited. Russia has violated its obligations with regard to human rights. Russia is not respecting the decisions of the European Court of Human Rights despite the fact that it's in the Russian constitution that these verdicts have to be respected in the country. So Putin is in violation of all possible international agreements that Russia has already concluded. What sense does it make to conclude new ones before these issues are resolved, before Putin does something practical to prove that he could be actually considered as a credible international player?
So that's it. That's a great point. And it raises the question, though, that what would do the trick? At what point would you see Putin as sufficiently deterred?
Well, Putin could be seen as sufficiently deterred if he starts to comply with his existing international commitments and obligations, which is if he investigates the poisoning of Alexei Navalny and terminates the program of development of chemical weapons, if he stops applying cyber warfare against European countries and America, if he de-escalates in Ukraine and starts to act in accordance with the Minsk agreements that he signed, if he, of course, releases political prisoners in accordance to Russian international human rights obligations.
Including Navalny, in this case, of
course. Including Navalny, of course.
So how is Alexei Navalny holding up?
Well, he is holding up. He has a very strong reservoir of moral powers and of designation to carry on. He's been transferred back to the penal colony, which is infamous for being very harsh, for being a torture colony, from the hospital where he recovered from his hunger strike. We hope that his condition will remain stable. So far, no bad news for him, and absence of bad news is, in this situation, already good news.
That's good to hear. I know that it wasn't too long ago that Navalny was on death's door. Do you think it is still Putin's intention to kill Navalny?
Vladimir Putin didn't try to kill Navalny in August 2020. He tried to kill him covertly. His plan was that when the plane lands, there is a dead body, and every doctor in Russia would say it was just a heart attack. That was the plan. So, and it makes a difference. So they didn't shoot him in his forehead, right? So it is important to understand that now, when Alexei Navalny is in Putin's custody, the world is watching. Everyone understands that if something bad happens to Alexei Navalny, then the perpetrator is very clear to everyone. So now, ironically, Alexei Navalny is relatively safe, but only to the point when the international attention doesn't fade away. So if he gets forgotten, then his life will be in imminent danger.
Are you worried it might fade away, that international attention?
We do our best not to let it happen, both internally, domestically, and internationally. So far, we see that the world leaders are not forgetting. It's our objective that every time Putin travels anywhere and meets anyone, Navalny issue is brought up. And I think it's very important also for the world, like, not to forget that someone is paying enormous price for Russian future democratic transition.
Great. Thank you, Leonid. So this is an anti-corruption podcast, fundamentally. We are the Making a Killing podcast, and we work on fighting kleptocracy. And of course, Putin's regime is the spitting image of a kleptocracy. It may be the kleptocracy one thinks of when one thinks of a kleptocracy, a completely top-down type of organization where you have a dictator surrounded by cronies. Those cronies have massive illicit networks all over the world, as well as within Russia. And Putin himself has that sort of thing. And of course, you are the Anti-Corruption Foundation. So wondering, from the corruption standpoint, what role does corruption play in Russian governance, and how have you exposed that role?
Corruption is the essence, the cornerstone, and I would say the reason for existence of Russian state of Russian government as of now, Putin has built a very funny system. It runs on corruption. You know, like how they investigate spread of cancer cells in the body. They put some small radioactive markers and then they see where those markers appear.
So if a CT scan, is that right?
Yeah. Sorry. if you put a radioactive marker on a 500 rubles bill that you give to an average policeman as a bribe for a small traffic offense, you will be able to trace this marker to Mr. Putin personally, to his palace.
Yes.
That's the system he's built. So it's kind of every time this average police officer has to give some money every day to his superior, and that has to give some money, like deliver some money, like every month to their chef. And so the whole system operates. In the 90s, like 30 years ago, there was, of course, also a lot of corruption in Russia. But then when they started to do something, like to build a school or to build a starship, they were thinking about like building it and then thinking, if there is an opportunity to steal something, maybe 3% or 5% of this procurement funds could be somehow like squeezed away. Now the situation turned like completely, like 180 degrees. Now they enter any new project for the sake of stealing money.
Yes, like and they Sochi, don't that sort of thing, yeah.
They don't really care if something will be built or not at the end of the day.
It's about getting that money, getting that dirty money. So tell me, Leonid, what is done with this money? You know, I mean, I think that what is the goal that you'd mentioned a palace earlier, and I know that you've done these incredible investigations into the way that where this money ends up, where the average Russian's money ends up, the money that's stolen directly from their pocketbooks, and how is this money used by the regime?
Well, they export it to the West. Even official data suggests, official statistics by the Russian Ministry of Finance suggests that $60 billion every year is a capital flow out of Russia. But of course, unofficially, they export much more, just in suitcases. And they buy properties. They buy private jets, luxury yachts, palaces, chateaus, hotels, resorts, whatever. Enormous amounts of Russian money are being stashed in Europe, in France, in Austria, mostly in UK, of course. And this money is also used to corrupt local officials. This money, well, when a Russian billionaire, Putin's friends, would buy themselves like a nice villa in Côte d'Azur, the next step, they will try to corrupt local policeman, local municipal deputy, local councillor, local judge. Mm-hmm. First of all, because that's the way they used to operate back there in Russia. That's just their modus operandi. Yes. And second, of course, so that questions not be asked about the source of their funds and so on and so on. We've done such a research back in 2014. I think it's still available on YouTube. It's called From Russia with Cash.
Yes, I am aware of that one, yes.
Yeah, some of our friends...
Necessary viewing for fans of this podcast.
Yeah, some of our friends approached 5 largest London real estate agencies with a story like, I'm being a deputy minister of Russian government and I have, £10 billion... pounds in cash, and I can't explain where does this cash come from. Could you please help me to buy a property here in Belgravia so that no one understands that it's mine? And 4 or 5 largest Royal London real estate agencies said yes. Of course, that's possible.
And let me also add that a similar experiment was done by Global Witness in New York City. And I believe they approached 13 law firms. This was, essentially acting as an African variant of that. And 12 of 13 asked no questions whatsoever, said, yes, we can get this done. We can launder your money. And I believe one of them was even president of the American Bar Association at the time. So, I mean, this is actually brings me very nicely, I think, to this next question, which really, I think, complicates your job quite a bit. And that is the complicity of these Western systems and enablers and gatekeepers and that sort sort of thing, the lawyers and accountants and auditors and whatever else that are working for Putin and his cronies. And I'm wondering, what needs to be done about that? I mean, what leverage does the West hold over Putin, and how can that leverage be realized?
Well, the West actually holds a lot of leverage because all these assets are being stored in the West. And the West has the legal framework, the Magnitsky Act, the American FSCPA law, that actually allows the West to go after those assets, to freeze them, to arrest them, to persecute people for stealing money from their home countries, in our case, from Russia. Of course, as you put it very correctly, this money is able to protect itself. Yes. This expensive lawyers and so on. This is something we hear in Germany, in Europe a lot. Like, we asked European decision makers to consider our proposal for the sanction list for Navalny poisoning to include closest circle of Putin oligarchs. And they told us, well, they will appeal to the High Court of Justice in Luxembourg. They will hire the best lawyers, and we will not be able to compete. We will not be able to prove the link between corruption and violation of human rights.
So there was actually...
And that struck me so much, because everyone who lives in a country in Russia, such as Russia, knows it by heart, feels how intimate is the connection between corruption and violation of human rights.
It's something I've always observed, too, that, you know, everyone knows it. You know, everybody always comes around, and every lobbyist, every association or whatever, and they always say, well, we don't know. Well, we don't know. You know, it's like, oh, give me a break. Like when somebody approaches you with $100 million in cash, you know, you know, like everybody knows. So it's one of those things that is just kind of extraordinary. So, but I'd wanted to ask you about the approach of the West toward Russia. Especially since the election of the Biden administration. Of course, there's an upcoming election in Germany, the role of the EU and all that, the UK now having left the European Union. What approach should the West be taking to Russia?
So the approach should be much more practical. It shouldn't be limited by just words. Otherwise, Putin is once again reassured that he could just do whatever he wants, and the West will only be deeply concerned or gravely concerned. Unfortunately, every time Western politicians talk about the red lines, Putin is only reaffirmed in his belief that the red lines actually do not exist. Practical actions, including sanctions against those oligarchs of Putin's closest circle, could be very powerful, could help to build leverage, could help to force Putin into negotiations and into concessions.
So, Leonid, as of 30, 40 minutes ago, you are officially a designated extremist. Is that right?
Your podcast is next.
The podcast?
I mean, so now it's officially acknowledged that talking about corruption, investigating corruption, fighting corruption is an extremist activity in Russia.
Yes. So what an extraordinary set of circumstances. So you know, we talked a bit about Alexei and his condition, but what about you? How are you holding up? How are your colleagues holding up? How is the Anti-Corruption Foundation now operating?
Well, we are operating in the virtual space. We would not go too much into detail of the physical presence of our organization, but be reassured that we will be able to maintain most of our activities. Well, of course, we had to formally dissolve our regional offices end of April just to protect the people there of this extremism charges, and they are now operating on their own. But the core of our organization, with the anti-corruption investigations, with our YouTube videos, with our YouTube channel, is intact and will continue its operations despite this extremist designation. Many things will be more challenging for us now. It will be, harder to operate. There will be increased pressure on tech platforms. Now, given there is a court verdict, Russian internet censorship body will once again try to blackmail Google and Facebook, like, to take down our content because it's now an extremist content because it's now a prohibited content in Russian. But we'll see. We hope we'll be able to.
And that's certainly something we'll have to keep an eye on. Is these tech platforms and ensuring that
tech platforms couldn't become enablers for kleptocrats.
That's right, and that is extremely important, especially. As we have seen in the example of China, many large corporations kind of doing the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party in violation of fundamental freedoms. So without access, and we've kind of seen this both now with your organization, but just the way that there's been a massive, massive crackdown in Russia on all organizations. RFERL has been run out. A lot of different organizations have been run out of Russia. So without access to Russia, what do you intend to investigate?
Well, we still intend to investigate corruption within Russia. Mm-hmm. But now, of course, we will also have more time and more desire to investigate export of corruption from Russia. It's becoming a very important topic. So not only how they steal money of Russian taxpayers, but where do they invest them and how they use them to influence also the political system of European countries. How Putin's money buys European politicians, how Putin's money is used to buy influence, how it endangers the foundation of European political system in very many different ways. I mean, Russia is a country run on corruption, and this has very many consequences for its neighbors that I have a feeling its neighbors do not really yet realize. So, for instance, Europe is soon to resume travel, tourism, for those vaccinated.
Yep.
Russia is a country run on corruption. A vaccination certificate costs 11 euro in Moscow.
Interesting.
And you're done. And is it dangerous for Europe? Yes, it is. Russia is the largest exporter of fertilizers to Europe. Fertilizers, well, these are chemical substances. They have to go with certification that they are safe. Well, it's not expensive in Russia to buy a certificate rather than to obtain it in a proper way. And so on and so on and so on. There are very many areas where actually a corrupt regime endangers its neighbors and partners.
It's an excellent point. And in fact, we talk a lot about the victims of kleptocracy, and they are legion. You know, the lost lives and livelihoods, defective and substandard products, everything, you know, government services, whatever. So and it can absolutely harm you when you're out of the country. I mean, you know, there's every indication that that COVID itself was the product of corruption and cover up, you know? So, I mean, there's so many ways that corruption harms everyone to every system that is connected to that kleptocracy.
Corruption kills.
And
in the world of 21st century, everything is connected.
Everything is connected.
Especially, of course, Russian-European ties are very close. And
yes.
We are very much connected. And Europe should be made aware of the risks of the dangers and should start to act accordingly.
Yeah. So what, for example, is your view on Nord Stream 2, which is a massive discussion currently and, of course, is one of these connections?
Well, Nord Stream 2 is a pipeline famous for the fact that its cost per kilometer, its construction cost per kilometer, dramatically changes when it crosses the German border. For some reason, the very same pipeline in Russian territorial sea costs three times more per kilometer as in the German.
Denser waters, right?
Yes. So, of course, it will not only pump oil or gas from Russia to Europe. It will also pump a lot of corruption into European economy.
So, with all of that said, and with it now very clear that Russia is run as a kleptocracy, and that the Russian people are being stolen from every day, and that money is being translated into the most tasteless, ostentatious things one could ever have. Including the palace, which you investigated. Are the people fed up with Putin? Are the Russian people ready to move on?
Those people who are not victims of Putin's propaganda, and especially younger people, of course, are fed up and want change. And people also consider corruption to be a major threat to their lives and to their future and the future of their children. It's probably a little bit underestimated, unfortunately. But actually, the most important effect of our activities during the last 10 years was the educational effect. Like, many people learned about corruption and how corruption actually influences their everyday life and really, like, steals their futures, their lives, their competitive chances, and so on and so on. So we changed the perception of corruption as a phenomenon within Russian society, and it's very important, and we'll continue doing this. And, I mean, politicians could be blamed of different things, and sometimes politicians are very well interested to resolve the issues they are blamed for. Putin could be criticized for this and that, and of course he tries to be nice, he tries to be popular, and when he is criticized for, I don't know, like a bad quality of a rod, he could just order this rod to be, you know, repaired, the pavement be repaired. So it's even more important for us to attack and to address corruption, because it's so essential for the core of the existence of Putin's regime that Putin can't do anything against it. Putin is probably now not very happy with the fact that the majority of Russian voters consider himself to be a corrupt president, but he can't do anything against it. It will stay with him forever, and at the end of the day, it will kill his political life, and it will, of course, be defining for his legacy.
Right, right. But does that pose a problem that Putin cannot peacefully step down, right?
Of course he cannot.
Putin is there until he's gone.
Yes, of course. It's very clear. Putin has taken this decision to stay in power forever, not later than in 2011, when they announced they would switch places with Medvedev, like, again, mm-hmm. and he would continue to be. We didn't know when he has taken this decision, maybe like 2009, 2010, but not later than 2011. In 2014, after annexation of Crimea, war in Ukraine, and shooting down the Boeing MH17, this decision became irreversible. He has lost the opportunity to change his mind.
Yes.
Since that time, we operate with well aware of the fact that Putin wants to stay in Kremlin forever. He's not ready to leave under any circumstances because this will just be too risky for him. The world, Putin is not unique. Russia is not unique in this sense. The world has seen many dictators quite similar. Unfortunately, there are many kleptocrats on the planet, and many have been. Like, you export national resources, you get hold of like 80% of proceeds,
yes.
You spend 10% on the propaganda, which explains to people that they never were as happy as they are now, and you spend another 10% to provide some moderate level of life to people so that they don't get too angry. That's not unique Putin's modus operandi. And we know
yes.
that many of such autocracies managed to survive until the biological death of their creator, unfortunately. For Putin, it might denote another 10 or even 20 years, a scenario we absolutely don't like. But the good news is that no of these kleptocracies managed to over-survive its founder.
Well, I always like ending on a good news. And certainly I agree with you on the nature of kleptocracy, that this is Putin's model is not unique to Russia. We've seen it before. We will see it again. Although I hope one day we can end kleptocracy as a governance form, because it's really bad. It's really bad for a lot of people and creates a great many victims. Leonid, thank you so much for being here with me today.
Thank you.
Well, hello and welcome to the news and analysis part of the show. As mentioned in the introduction, the first bit of news comes from Hudson Institute itself this week, and I'm very pleased to welcome Casey and Paul, not only as my co-hosts on the podcast this week, but as fellows on the Kleptocracy Initiative. So we'll be working together, not just on the podcast, but events, bringing out more research, op-eds, all the stuff to give you more insights into this increasingly prominent and pervasive problem of transnational corruption and kleptocracy. Guys, welcome to the podcast this week, but also welcome to Hudson Institute.
Thanks, Nate.
So good to be here, Nate.
It's wonderful to be among fellow fellows. It's obviously an honor, and keep that kleptomentum going.
Kleptomentum!
Indeed. Well, on the which note, what a week to join, because I personally, correct me if I'm wrong, perhaps we're going to have a debate, but I think we might look back on the past week as perhaps one of the most momentous, most significant in the whole of America's history of fighting corruption and kleptocracy, with the announcement from the White House, from President Biden himself, that fighting corruption is now a core U.S. national security interest, putting it on the same level as things like terrorism, like nuclear proliferation, climate change, any of the usual things that you would think, and requiring, as mentioned, this whole of government approach, reporting back to the president within 200 days. On a plan to go forward and elevate this fight. Casey, I wonder if you could kick us off. What is your reaction to this news this week? Is this all it's cracked up to be?
Yeah, Nate, I think you hit the nail on the head there, that this is absolutely a week, a series of statements, series of decisions out of the White House that in some number of years' time, I absolutely think and I absolutely concur that we may look back on this period as a seismic shift in how the U.S. not only approaches, but also addresses these growing, as you mentioned, pervasive threats of corruption, transnational corruption, obviously what we have come to describe as and identify as modern kleptocracy and all the threats emanating therein. So, just to give a quick rundown, what we saw over the last week is frankly something that we have been waiting for from this administration ever since January 20th, and frankly, ever since the election results came in last November. Yep. And that is the statements, the framing at the highest level of American government, of the executive branch, placing the threats of corruption and the threats of kleptocracy as a national threat to American core interests, a national security interest on the U.S. side. So what we saw from the White House was a brand new national security study memorandum. And I'll just read a quick quote from the memo that came out from the White House. This was President Biden speaking. He said, "I establish countering corruption as a core United States national security interest. My administration will lead efforts to promote good governance, bring transparency to the United States and global financial systems, prevent and combat corruption at home and abroad, and make it increasingly difficult for corrupt actors to shield their activities." Now, there were a couple other documents that came out of the White House as well, including a transcript from the press briefing that the White House also held last week that went into a few more details. But just to reiterate what I mentioned a moment ago, this is the document, this is the decision, and this, frankly, is the week that so many of us were anticipating, were hoping for. And, I think as some of the things we've mentioned on previous episodes and certainly with previous guests, we're now 4 or 5 months into the administration, and we had seen certain elements, we'd seen certain bits of momentum or certain decisions that have been taken, obviously, the administration dealing with any number of other issues, but you could sense there was a little bit of growing frustration, sense there was a little bit of growing criticism with this perceived lethargy as it pertains to the Biden administration's approach to corruption and to kleptocracy. And I think, frankly, that is no more. Because again, this is what we were waiting for. This is what we were looking for. Just to pick on two little bits of analysis that came out afterward, we have our good friend of the podcast, Josh Rudolph, over at the Alliance for Securing Democracy. He had this wonderful quote where he said, "White House officials have kept their heads down and laid the groundwork for what could become the most sweeping policy initiative against corruption and kleptocracy in U.S. history." And then the second quote is from Alexander Raggi at the FCPA blog, which is another wonderful outlet. "The whole of government mobilization against corruption appears to mark a fundamental change for the United States." And I want to pause on that. This is a fundamental change for the U.S. in how it approaches, how it addresses, and how it frames the policy solution to countering corruption, placing it at the center of the U.S.'s core national security interest. Now, obviously, the question is, how much of this is simply rhetoric? How much of this is simply putting out statements, putting out documents for the sake of sating or solving some of the criticism that the administration had faced? And certainly time will tell. But there are two elements within this that I think I do want to highlight as it pertains to specific steps moving forward. One, we saw the administration address in Biden's statement what he called strategic corruption. And that is something we've also discussed on the podcast before. That is the ability of foreign regimes, kleptocratic regimes, to use specifically corrupt figures and networks to affect, to upend, and to impact American and Western policy. That's an area that I'm certainly keen to follow with great interest about what the administration will do on that front. And then in the press briefing, we also saw that the administration said they will be taking additional steps to end anonymity, not in shell companies, obviously, with Congress leading the way on that, but specifically in American real estate, which, again, is something we've talked about time and again, and we've seen
and something we've been waiting for
for a long time. Absolutely. If there is one next domino that needs to fall, it is absolutely transparency in American real estate. And again, we'll wait to see what the administration does on that front. They have a couple tools in their arsenal that would be relatively easy, relatively low lifts to implement, but certainly it seems like they're paying attention to it. So those are the two elements within that I'm paying attention to.
And Casey, some of those points of strategy that you were discussing, so the memo's broken down into, you know, the statement and then strategy and then sort of interagency review. And the part of the strategy piece, a lot of those points, practically every single one of them, describes bills in Congress right now. So I mean, it's really exciting to kind of clearly see the administration having taken a little inspiration from the great work that Congress has done, and of course, the previous Congress banned anonymous shell companies. So clearly, there is a strong bipartisan basis for this kind of action, and maybe in fighting corruption, may well next to China, because we just saw yesterday the Senate passed a major $250 billion China bill. But next to China, and they're really the same issue as we've discussed before, but countering corruption is where the bipartisan momentum is.
So just to flag quickly, the other major sort of development from the administration the past week, clearly coming off the back of President Biden's announcement, was the vigor with which Administrator Samantha Power over at the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has embraced the anti-corruption agenda as well. She announced... Mm-hmm. Probably the first solid, you know, she's not waiting 200 days. She already had a plan ready to go, which involves the creation of a rapid response fund capacity over at USAID to respond to moments of historic opportunity. And Paul, I see you raising your eyebrows because you've been involved, of course, in the ongoing advancement of the so-called Crook Act, which is exactly would do the same.
Right, which is mm-hmm. of course like essentially what is the flagship bill of the anti-corruption movement, left and right, up, down, center, the Countering Russian Overseas Kleptocracy Act.
A nicer lining of administration plans and congressional plans there already.
Yeah, so, they're convergent.
It's pretty high for the next 200 days, I think, on the rest of it.
And it's amazing, and that's welcome, of course. You know, you definitely want to see everything converge. You want the branches to find consensus, and American government works when we find consensus. That's the point. And we found consensus on this, and that's extremely exciting. So I guess just to add to what Casey said about this memo, I mean, what it is, it's a study memo, right? So now we're waiting 200 days, right? And the sort of clock's counting down to what's next. And I think that, you know, it's, I mean, I want to echo Casey in that, like, you know, this is extraordinary. You know, I mean, this is just like something to celebrate in an unbelievable way. And there are two sides, of course, to the counter-kleptocracy fight. Their narrative and policy. And on the narrative side, this is a 11 out of 10, can't beat it. This is the best possible thing one could get. And on the policy side, we'll see. But I mean, every indication is it could be the real deal on the policy side too. And what's
sure, because we should remember the Biden administration has taken some pretty controversial decisions or not taken some controversial decisions. You know, Nord Stream 2,
right.
Response to Belarus, response to Navalny.
Which Nord Stream 2 is, of course, the largest and most visible strategic mm-hmm. corruption project in the world today. So I mean, yeah, you know, there are reasons to sort of keep an eye on this, of course, and to wonder what will come down the line. But I guess I just, you know, it's like we can talk about that, you know, further down the line, and we have to keep an eye on it, and we have to see what comes in, you know, 200 days later. But I'll say narratively, It's amazing.
I was going to say, Paul, I want to highlight that one of the terms that you used was convergence, you know, and I'm thinking of you know, working in concert or consilience between the executive branch and legislative branch, and even beyond that, the multiple you know, elements that comprise the executive branch itself. Obviously, the study memo requiring those multiple entities under the presidency to specifically address and to specifically propose and then implement policies therein. But all of this convergence, all of this consilience is, if nothing else, a very clear, at least rhetorical and narrative-driven restoration of much-needed American leadership in the anti-kleptocracy yes. space. And I know much of our conversations you know, on this podcast are rounding up the news of the last few weeks, rounding up the news of specific decisions, of specific developments. But I think it's worth taking a step back every once in a while and surveying the anti-corruption, counter-kleptocracy space over the past few years and, frankly, over the past few decades. And what we have seen is any time, or at least certainly most times, there is significant headway made in the effort to combat kleptocratic regimes, kleptocratic networks, kleptocratic figures. It is the Americans. It is Washington taking a clear leadership stance and stake in the issue. And to see that coming about once more is not only certainly a welcome development in and of itself, an incredibly welcome development in and of itself, but it's a continuation of a proven pattern that we have seen play out over the past few decades. And I am, you know, it's Christmas and summertime. I am very excited to see where
teenage boys on the podcast this week.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we've talked about it before, but I, you know, just to emphasize, I mean, counter-kleptocracy is something that unites American domestic and foreign policy. It's something that really gets down to the core of what it means to be American. And I mean, at a time when we have this, you know, very polarized people split in the way that it is, counter-kleptocracy is a uniting call. It's a uniting rallying cry. That seems to be something that everybody can support and wants to support, because nobody wants leaders that steal from them anywhere in the world, and nobody wants to be complicit in that. So it's really quite an extraordinary thing.
It's a tremendous way to re-engage with populations around the world that are currently, you know, experiencing disillusionment with democracy, with capitalism and the rest of it. To my mind, it is the way that we you know, rejuvenate American leadership for the 21st century. But I wanted to, on that note, on the foreign policy note, interesting article out of the UK this morning about how the UK as the author Patrick Winter argues, has lost global anti-corruption leadership despite so many promising advances and new laws being passed under David Cameron. You know, and it was a leader on corporate transparency, for example. What do you think the timing of? I don't want to sort of dig into. It's not the sort of main focus of the podcast today, but it just made me think. We have a number of really important international meetings coming up over the next year. How do you guys think that Biden's new stance will be received among our allies and partners? For example, you know, I'm thinking of the UK, not just because I'm from there, but because Boris, in contrast to his predecessors, has shown no interest in this issue whatsoever, despite the fact he has many officials I know within the UK government who are raring to go on this. He's now seen, right before the start of the G7 kicks off in his own country, President Biden has kind of said, this is the national security priority for the United States. Do you think he's suddenly sort of scrambling to sort of bring his own shop into order? Would you expect to see the Europeans do the same? You know, do you think this will be well received overseas?
I'll just jump in, you know, quickly, Nate. You know, I think to reiterate something I just mentioned, you know, we would not see, or presumably would not see, nearly as much momentum or movement toward the implementation of specific counter-kleptocracy policies, strategies with our European partners, with British partners, without the necessary American leadership on this. And, you know, just to get back to Biden's statement, I'm not going to predict one way or the other how Boris Johnson is going to respond to this. Obviously, Nate, as you mentioned, there's certainly significant internal pressure to get his government moving on some of these specific policies. And just to reiterate, you know, that piece in The Guardian was a very strong rundown of the numerous setbacks that London has seen over the past few years. But none of this is going to happen without the American stance, American clarity on the threats emanating from these kleptocratic regimes, from these kleptocratic networks, and then some of these specific policy proposals therein. So that's kind of a roundabout way of saying, I have absolutely no idea how Boris Johnson is going to respond, but certainly the significant pressure I have to imagine that the Americans are going to be placing on his government to finally get moving on any number of policies, whether it's corporate registries, whether it's budgeting for increasing the unexplained wealth orders enforcement, whatever it may be, you know, having the Americans not breathing down your back per se, but certainly encouraging as strongly as possible is a wonderful tool to have on our side in this broader counter kleptocracy fight.
And let me also, let me sound a note of optimism. I mean, we have seen from the UK an interest in Magnitsky corruption sanctions, the implementation of Magnitsky corruption sanctions. We certainly see that Dominic Raab wants to, the foreign minister wants to prioritize this stuff. And then on the continent, even the EU just went operational with the European Public Prosecutor's Office, something we've been waiting for a long time, which is essentially like an EU-wide DOJ led by the former head of the Romanian National Anti-Corruption Directorate, Kövesi, a very impressive person. Not only that, and then now in Berlin, in Germany, you have... an election in September where Merkel is running neck and neck. Well, Merkel's not running again, but the CDU is running neck and neck with the Greens. And the Greens, of course, the chancellor candidate, Annalena Baerbock, is opposed to Nord Stream 2. She's very critical of China and Russia. The Greens seem to really understand and speak about this, this issue, the counter-kleptocracy, climate change, all sorts of stuff. So I think that, we should never ignore that within countries and within governments, including our own, because, it does seem like even in this administration, the left hand doesn't always know what the right hand's doing, right? And and there are competing factions trying to get their issue through. And I think that this memo is hugely advantageous to those fighting in every one of these, battles, to prioritize the fight against global corruption.
And if I could just one quick add on the back of this, when we discuss the transatlantic partnership, when we discuss transatlantic alliance or consilience as it pertains to some of these policies, we talk about the Americans, the Brits, the Americans, and the Europeans. Often we leave out the Canadians. Often we leave out what Ottawa is doing, what Ottawa is saying. And again, Canada has many of the same financial anonymity issues that certainly the U.S. does as it pertains to shell companies, as it pertains to real estate, as it pertains to a number of other industries. But the Canadians are also making significant headway, very much following in the Americans' path on this, and would be will continue to be a fantastic partner moving forward, both as it pertains to investigation and prosecution, as well as in the policy space. So I just wanted to make sure we're including the Canadians in the discussion as we continue the discourse on this.
I'm sure they'll be very grateful for that, Casey.
I'm
joking, but it's true. It's important. It's not just the big financial centers like the US and the UK and the EU. It's the Five Eyes alliance as well. There's all sorts of in India, Japan, there are all sorts of people who are ready to get engaged on this.
The single most effective coordinated moment of sanctions has been these coordinated global Magnitsky sanctions against officials in Xinjiang. That was Canada, the United States, the UK, and the EU. It was an extremely impressive move. So much so that the CCP shot itself in the foot in response by imposing these sanctions on everybody else. So you're absolutely right. You got to have everybody, and you got to have them acting in concert.
And the great thing that those sanctions showed, Paul, that was that sort of process is now in place. Like they can coordinate sanctions because they'd never done that before. We weren't sure if they could do it.
Yeah.
Every country has different capacity for its different departments, and especially during coronavirus, these officials were at home. They couldn't access the classified information they weren't working on. So it's doubly impressive in my mind. And I think, we'll probably see a lot more of that. But without getting sort of too giddy, there is another great development coming out of Washington. if our viewers will sort of bear with us and being slightly over enthusiastic this week. And Paul, I'm going to kick it over to you for that one, because we've got some really great news coming out of Congress this week as well, right?
Right. Well, of course, it's what made that week so big, is that both branches of government, both Article 1 and Article 2, have prioritized this issue. And 24 hours before the president made his declaration, the Congress announced a caucus against foreign corruption and kleptocracy, 17 bipartisan members of Congress that will be prioritizing the fight against the national security threat of global corruption. Through a series of bills, through hearings, through staff level events, through, press releases, op-eds, all sorts of stuff to get to educate other members, of course, to raise the profile of these issues, and to speak directly to constituents about the way that this problem is affecting them. And in fact, Casey and I recently were able to publish a piece in Foreign Policy discussing exactly that, exactly how kleptocracy is dismantling, harming the lives of average Americans all over this country. And we suspect we're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. So that's really what this counter-kleptocracy caucus will focus on, looking at exactly how this massive amount of dirty money that's been funneled into this country is harming the average American and is hurting our national security.
Yeah, exactly. Just to pick up on Paul's point, you know, the piece in Foreign Policy that he mentioned, much of it was framed as the fact that, you know, when we talk about kleptocracy, when we talk about these kleptocrats worth millions, and in some cases, billions of dollars, you know, traditionally we associate them with the Miamis and the Malibus and the Manhattans of the world and the beachfront condos and the, you know, penthouses and the mansions. But that is clearly an outdated mechanism with which to view or envision these figures. They are now targeting these small towns. They are now targeting the mid-tier cities. They are now targeting significant commercial and manufacturing assets. I mean, and this is just in the U.S. alone. I mean, this is to say nothing of what they're doing in Canada or what they're doing on the continent in Europe as well, or Australia or New Zealand for that matter. Just to reiterate what Paul was saying, that this is now an issue that absolutely and as clear as day affects each and every one of us, certainly here in the U.S. as well as elsewhere. And, you know, the fact that this caucus, the first of its kind, the only one of its kind that exists anywhere in the world, is now officially launched, to say nothing of the bills that are coming, is, you know, Nate, I think it's okay to be giddy this week. I think it's okay to embrace the giddiness. These opportunities are few and far between.
It's rare. Oftentimes in kleptocracy, it's cynical, it's frustrating, it's paranoid, absolutely. But this week, we can really be exciting. It's exciting.
Take the good news when it comes along.
That's right.
And it comes along like buses. You wait forever and then two come along at once.
That's right. Exactly.
Kleptobus.
I like that. I like the kleptobus. Yeah, kleptomentum. Kleptomentum with the kleptobus. I wanted to pick up on something Casey just said there, because we are now in the middle of counter-kleptocracy month, which the caucus, is an initiative of the caucus, and the caucus, members of the caucus will be introducing a bill a week, including this week. One will be coming down the line soon, the Justice for Victims of Kleptocracy Act, and that simply mandates that the DOJ put on a publicly accessible website the amount of assets that have been hidden in the United States, illicit assets hidden in the United States and recovered by U.S. law enforcement and listed by country. So anyway, we can do another time when I talk through some of the bills that have been introduced. Of course, we are still in the pre-introduction phase, but in any case, it's very exciting stuff. And that will go on until the end of June.
That's fantastic. Guys, any other news you want to sort of flag from the past couple of weeks that may be of interest?
Yeah, the only other bit, again, just to lean into this kind of giddiness that we see, obviously, from the White House as well, not just the national security memo or security study memo that we saw last week. You know, the White House also announced it was issuing one of its largest, perhaps the largest, if I remember correctly, single sanctions package against dozens of Bulgarian nationals on account of, again, the kind of transnational corruption schemes that we have seen, oligarchic figures out of Bulgaria. And, you know, that in and of itself is interesting, fascinating, and certainly worth highlighting. But what I want to kind of extract from that is that it highlights the Americans' willingness to, and certainly the White House's willingness to, sanction nationals and prominent nationals within not the Russias of the world, not the Kazakhstans of the world, not the Chinas of the world, but American allies. I mean, Bulgaria is a very strong American NATO ally, obviously a member of the European Union as well, and the Americans' willingness to do that is proof that these figures cannot simply hope that if they remain within a NATO country or a European Union country, they will be absolved of any concerns about sanctions. I mean, I think this is proof that those corrupt networks, those corrupt individuals, wherever they are certainly fair game and are certainly worth pursuing.
That's right. And of course, there is precedent for that in Latvia, Belgium, Israel. So it was absolutely thrilling to see it happen once again. The last thing I'll flag, there is one more thing with the caucus. Tomorrow is the launch event, the official launch event at June 10th at 4 p.m. So if you somehow listen to this podcast before then, you know, tune in for that.
Paul, is there anybody we know will be at the launch event?
Yeah, it'll be the Senator Ben Cardin will be kicking it off, welcoming the caucus. The co-chairs, which are Representatives Melanowski, Curtis, Keating, and Fitzpatrick, will then be making remarks. And finally, we'll follow it up with a panel from Gary Kalman of TI, Friedrich Obermeier of the Panama Papers fame, Süddeutsche Zeitung, Nate Sibley of the Kleptocracy Initiative, And finally, Elaine Dzensky of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Well, I'm really looking forward to taking part. I'm honored to be there. It's the culmination of a lot of hard work by you, Paul. I mean, you know, we could, you know, without getting too, it's getting way too gushy at this point, but, you know, you're the staffer who really led on putting this together in many respects behind the scenes. So a personal congratulations to you. And, you know, we try and get people on to interview, but, you know, you're the guy who kind of put that together behind the scenes. So congrats. And I'm looking forward to all the good work that's going to come out of the caucus. I think that's probably all we've got time for this week. So apologies if it was too much good news for people who tune in to listen to the very depressing world of transnational corruption and kleptocracy. But I'm sure the kleptocrats will be up to their tricks, and we will be back with more of that kind of stuff next week. So thanks very much, guys.
Yeah, always more room for cynicism in the future.
Yeah.
On that note.
plenty of bad news coming down the line.
thanks, Nate. Great episode.
Thanks, guys.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Making a Killing. If so, please remember to subscribe and share with your friends. Casey, Paul and I will be back in a couple of weeks with more interviews and insights from those on the front line of the global fight against corruption and kleptocracy.